Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good evening and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor of Cure Talks, joining you from India. And today we are talking about multiple myeloma. This is Cure Talks' 109th episode. On the myeloma panel, we have myeloma survivors and advocates Cynthia Chmielewski and Yelek Biro and Jack Aiello. Our co-host of Myeloma Talks, Gary Peterson, is not able to join us today. So my co-host for the day is myeloma survivor and advocate Jack Aiello. Smoldering multiple myeloma is an asymptomatic clonal plasma cell disorder. There have been major advances in the diagnosis, prognosis, and management of smoldering myeloma in the last few years. High-risk SMM patients carry a high risk to progression to multiple myeloma. High-risk smoldering myeloma has been recognized as the optimal phase to test early treatment strategies. The upcoming ASCEND trial aims to prevent progression to active myeloma by 30 to 50% in the high-risk to progression smoldering patients. We are talking to Dr. Shaji Kumar, principal investigator of the trial and Mayo Clinic expert, about the nuances of the ASCEND trial. Before I hand over to Jack, I would like to remind our listeners that we will be addressing questions sent in towards the end of the show. If you would like to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad and let us know. You may also email them to priya@trialx.com or post them on the Cure Talks website. With that, it's over to Jack.
Thank you, Priya, and thanks for making these programs available to myeloma patients. As you noted, I'm subbing for Gary Peterson, who usually moderates these programs. He's unavailable, and I always appreciate what he does and hope I can do him justice. I'll introduce Dr. Shaji Kumar with a little bit of background. I've known Dr. Kumar for several years now, but I know he got his medical degrees out of All India Institutes of Medical Sciences and primarily has done his research and practice at the Mayo Institute in Rochester for the last nearly 20 years. Dr. Kumar, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jack. Thanks for having me.
So I'll begin by asking you some questions that, so that we all understand the design of the ASCEND trial, because as Priya mentioned, there are some very lofty goals in that trial. Said it's a trial for high-risk smoldering myeloma patients, so that means it's not for MGUS, not for myeloma patients, not for other smoldering patients. Can you, though, for us define high-risk smoldering myeloma, because I know that's different than high risk as defined for myeloma patients.
Right, Jack, you're absolutely correct. And I think this particular clinical trial, like a few other ones that are currently being designed around the world, really represents a paradigm shift in how we think about this disease. So for the longest time, almost 3-4 decades since we have known this disease and have had some treatments, we always thought, yes, this is incurable disease, so we don't do any treatment until it's really starting to do something bad. We didn't want to give side effects to people where none existed. I mean, we don't want to give symptoms to people that didn't exist already. So the traditional approach to smoldering multiple myeloma has been to just wait and watch. Now, the problem with smoldering multiple myeloma all along has been that it is a very mixed bag of diagnosis. We all know the vast majority of patients with MGUS do very well. 3/4 of them will live their whole life without having anything that needs to be done for them for the monoclonal gammopathy. On the other hand, we know that about 20 to 25% of these patients will eventually develop myeloma. And once they get active myeloma, symptomatic myeloma, that means they are starting to have symptoms from it, or they have some damage to the body from the plasma cells or the myeloma cells. Now, the smoldering is sitting on the fence between these two. And even though we talk about smoldering myeloma as a diagnosis, over the years, we have understood that this is really not a true diagnosis. Rather, it is a mix of patients with either myeloma or already is more like muggers. But we just don't have a good test for a given patient to say which side or which direction those cells are leaning towards. So over time, what we have looked at is to try and see who are the people who are at high risk of going on to get myeloma. We already know from the studies that Dr. Kyle have done decade ago that patients, there are about half of the patients with smoldering diagnosis will get myeloma in the first 5 years after that initial recognition of smoldering myeloma. You could argue that these patients have already kind of are sitting on the other side of the fence almost in terms of the evolution to myeloma. Another 15-16% will get myeloma in the next 5 years. And beyond that, the remaining patients who have not had a diagnosis of active myeloma behaves more like a muggers patient. So these patients have a 1% risk of progression to myeloma. So in a way, just watching over time tells us who really is a muggers versus who really is already leaning towards myeloma. Now, what we have, now the treatments for myeloma has really changed over the past decade, and now we have safer drugs, we have combinations that can potentially give very high response rates, meaning that we can get the disease under control, and we can actually get to what we call the minimal residual disease negative status in patients with myeloma. So then everyone's been asking the question, now we have good treatments, can we identify or carve out groups of patients from within that smoldering group who actually have a very, very high risk of getting to myeloma? So the exercise that has been ongoing has been to identify patients who have an 80%+ risk of getting or transforming to myeloma from within the smoldering myeloma group. And we basically gave those people the diagnosis of myeloma, and we would treat those patients just like myeloma. So that is the change in the diagnostic criteria for myeloma that happened in the past year and a half. Now, the paradigm shift that I was talking about was that whole concept of treating somebody who does not have the symptoms yet. And that was with the understanding that these people, there's very, very high risk that the myeloma is going to happen, so we don't want something bad to happen before we start treating. Now, we are kind of stretching that paradigm a little bit more to encompass a larger group of patients with smoldering myeloma who have a very high risk of getting myeloma, but not as high as the people whom we have redefined as myeloma. So a lot of different factors have been used for defining high-risk smoldering. So what we want to use for this particular clinical trial is based on the bone marrow plasma cell percentage, the free light chain ratio, and the M-spike levels, which is what we have used historically or traditionally. But the other aspect of this whole series of trials that are being done is to ask the question, if we intervene early, is there a possibility that we could actually cure the disease? Now, we don't have any evidence to prove that, but there is enough evidence that supports the exploration of that question. Now, those evidence comes from different sources. We know that patients with smoldering myeloma have less of genetic abnormalities or genome or mutations compared to patients with active myeloma, relapsed myeloma. So conceptually, we are talking about a myeloma cell that is less evolved compared to somebody with active myeloma. The second evidence comes from the transplants that we have done for patients with amyloidosis, where we know that the plasma cells are not as evolved as the myeloma cell, but most of the symptoms come from the protein itself. And we know that when we do stem cell transplant in patients with amyloid, those plasma cells stay away almost three times as long as what it does in myeloma. So there's some evidence to suggest that maybe intervening early is a good thing. Now, the question we would like to answer with these trials is, can we actually cure the disease? That's one question. Even if we don't cure the disease, can we actually kind of reset the switch so that these things don't start acting up for a prolonged period of time, which could also be of significant benefit both from quality of life as well as the cost of care. So in essence, what we are really trying to do is to take those high-risk patients, give them treatment that we would otherwise give for myeloma, but for a defined period of time, and see if we can reset the clock or maybe even cure the disease.
So just to confirm, I didn't quite understand, though, what the eligibility criteria are or the definition is of high risk to be used in this trial.
Right. For this particular trial, what we're going to use is a combination of serum M-spike that's more than 3 grams, an involved to uninvolved free ligation ratio that's more than 8, and a plasma cell percentage that's more than 10.
Okay. And can you explain the trial design?
Yes. So the way we're going to do this trial, as many of you would know, that the combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone is a very effective combination. And there's actually phase 3 trials currently ongoing in myeloma. So we have taken that combination and added daratumumab to that. And we already know that the daratumumab is quite efficacious in patients with myeloma. So what we are hoping is we would give these patients 4 cycles of treatment with daratumumab, carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone. And that is what we would call as induction. Then half of the patients will have the option to go to a stem cell transplant. And this would be the group of patients who are considered eligible and willing to go to a transplant. And the patients who are ineligible or don't want to get a transplant will be on the other arm. There is no randomization. This is basically depending upon the intent for transplant. So half of those patients, which would be 41 patients, will get a stem cell transplant. The other 41 patients will get 4 more cycles of the same combination. And then everybody will get 4 more cycles of consolidation with slightly reduced doses of the same medication. And then everybody gets what we call a maintenance treatment for a year, which will include the carfilzomib and the daratumumab in those patients, along with lenalidomide, but not dexamethasone. So the overall treatment would last a total of 2 years. And then at that point, we will stop treatment, and then we will look and see if we have managed to get an MRD negative state. And then we will repeat the testing a year after that to see if the patients are still staying in the MRD negative state. And they will be watched closely after that.
And I want to make sure I heard correctly. The maintenance regimen is, did you say it's Dara plus carfilzomib plus Revlimid for a year?
That is right, for a year.
And when do you expect to start the trial?
So the protocol is all ready, so we need to have some of the agreements in place with the pharmaceutical companies, and then we also need to get the FDA IND, and then the individual sites will have to put it through their own institutional review boards. So we hope that we can get this trial open by before the end of the year.
And are there any somewhat unique, either inclusion or exclusion criteria for patients that will want to investigate this trial?
No, so the only thing that is the diagnosis of smoldering and having to meet those 3 criteria.
Right.
And patients
okay.
also need to have adequate kidney function.
No previous treatment, I presume.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And since you're talking about cure, I presume, as you mentioned earlier, minimum residual disease testing is somehow incorporated into this trial. Can you say can you talk about when one will have MRD testing?
Right. So along the study, along the clinical trial, there are going to be some bone marrows that are going to be done in a timed fashion. So after we finish each of those phases of treatment, like the induction, the consolidation, and the maintenance, and then 1 year after the end of treatment. So in all these samples, we will estimate the plasma cell population and see if there's any minimal residual disease left.
And if someone is apparently MRD negative at the first time you've taken it and the second time you take it, you would at least consider them cured for the time being?
If they remain negative at least a year after the end of the treatment. So we want to make sure that they stay negative despite not getting any treatment, at least for a year.
And by the end of treatment, you mean a year after maintenance is done?
Year after the maintenance is done.
Got it.
So if they are still negative, then we hope that will translate to a cure. But obviously, that is what the study will tell us.
Right. Well, thanks so much for I understand it better now, and I know that both Yilak and Cindy have some questions. So, Yilak, if you're on the phone, I will turn it over to you.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Kumar, for taking the time to talk about this important Black Swan Research Initiative-based trial with the myeloma community. I actually have three questions, which I'll bundle as two, so the moderator will let me get away with it. My first question is, you mentioned that the three things that are used as inclusion, and you didn't mention FISH or gene expression profiling as part of the inclusion or exclusion criteria. Can you explain why? And then as a follow-up to that, and this is submitted by several of the questions that were submitted, what is the rationale for not choosing to randomize those patients that are transplant eligible and achieve MRD negativity after the first four cycles of the DARA-KRd regimen?
Right. So in terms of the so we want to keep the trial as simple as possible, and we wanted to go with something that, you know, we have validated extensively in thousands of patients in terms of risk factors for progression. While both FISH and gene expression profiling has been shown in smaller studies to be prognostic or predictive of progression, it is not something that has been studied extensively. And again, the gene expression profiling especially, and I think using just commonly available tests makes it much more easy and also makes it more comparable to what is being done elsewhere. So remember, this is a small study, right? It's not going to give us a definitive information. It will give us information that we might still need to be confirmed by other randomized trials. But at the same time, what is happening around the world is there are multiple of these phase two small clinical trials exploring the question of the cure possibility. And they are all looking at, you know, the traditional ways of risk stratifying patients. So we can at least compare the results among the studies. So there are multiple reasons why we are not using the gene expression profiling. In terms of the randomization, you know, I think eventually we will have to come to that question as to whether, you know, we would randomize patients right from the beginning or we would randomize patients based on the MRD test results later on. But I think that is the next question that we need to ask. So if, let's say, this study will tell us in few years that maybe, you know, most of the patients gets to be MRD negative, or half of the patients continue to be MRD negative after a year or after 4 years of treatment, then the next question would be, you know, does everybody need the same treatment, or can some people get away with less of treatment? So I think that those kind of questions will need to be asked eventually, but probably not at this point.
Okay. And then the follow-up questions I have for you is, how were the dosage and the cycle amounts chosen for this trial?
Right. So that's a good question. The, you know, there's obviously this particular, the combinations have been studied, right? So we know what combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone is safe in patients with myeloma, and it's well tolerated. And we looked at the data from Dr. Jakubowiak as well as what we know from the ECOG trial and also from what has been published by the other groups, like also in the ASPIRE trial. And we used the standard dose of daratumumab because it doesn't have any real overlapping toxicity between these drugs. Now, the four cycles of induction before transplant has been fairly standard. So I think by staying with the usual convention, we can also compare what has been happening in other areas, for example, in myeloma. So for if you take, for example, the French trial or even the BMT-CTN trial that completed accrual, what they have done is the four cycles of induction, then transplant or some other form of consolidation, and then maintenance after that. So we have kind of tried to structure the length of the different segments of therapy similar to what we have historically been doing in myeloma.
Cindy?
Okay.
Thanks, Yilak. And I did count. You had three questions. So, Cindy, I know you have a bullet, but Cindy, if you have a third, you're welcome to ask it as well.
Okay. Thank you so much. I guess my first question will stick along with the ASCENT trial. And it says that I've heard that the goal of the cure rate would be between 30 to 50% for the people in the high-risk multiple myeloma category. And I guess I'll put my two questions in here at the same time. How did you reach the 30 to 50% cure rate? Would those patients be the ones that if you did a gene expression profile or FISH study, that they would be considered more on the low risk or intermediate risk? Even though those testing isn't being done as inclusion or exclusion criteria, will that be done as part of the data that you're collecting during this study? And just curious how you got those numbers and how might this be possible?
Sure. No, I think that's a very good question. We don't really know. You know, we think that we are curing probably some patients with myeloma because we know we have patients, you know, obviously you all know patients who are 10 and 15 years out from the diagnosis or even 20 years out from the diagnosis doing well, and many of them don't have any evidence of myeloma. And so obviously we are already curing some people, and the best guesstimate, I would say, based on all the modeling type things, is we're probably doing that for somewhere between 10 and 20% of patients currently. So we wanted to look at you know, something more than that. And is there anything magical about the 50%? No. I think part of it is just kind of justifying the number of people you need to study to give an estimate that is reasonably confident. Oh, that reason that we can be reasonably confident about. So that's
okay.
Where the 30 to 50% comes from.
Okay. And I know that there's been some other trials for the high-risk multiple myeloma population. Can you talk a little bit about what those trials are and if we have seen any outcomes of those trials just yet?
Absolutely. No, I think, you know, this is increasingly becoming an area of intense investigation. So I would say there have been some trials in the past that have used thalidomide, for example, but the results have been quite mixed because of the fact, again, there can be significant neuropathy with thalidomide. But I think we have really, I mean, the area has really taken on with the introduction of these new drugs like lenalidomide. So the Spanish group did the trial where they randomized patients to lenalidomide dexamethasone versus just observation. And they were able to show that not only did the use of lenalidomide dexamethasone decrease the risk of progression as we would anticipate, it also made the patients live longer. Now, this was the results that were published a couple of years ago, and there was an update that was published last month, again showing the same thing, that the improvement in the overall survival is significant and continues to be that way. One of the interesting things in that study was that, you know, again, one of the concerns we have had was if we use that PET drug as for smoldering, what happens when they really need another treatment? Is it going to compromise their subsequent treatment? And when we look at the data from the long-term results, it's clear that using the lenalidomide early to delay the progression of myeloma does not compromise the responses they have from the subsequent treatment. So I think that is very good, strong evidence, but obviously it's only one clinical trial, And obviously, we also used a combination of lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and we would like to know how much is Revlimid alone doing it. So there's the ECO clinical trial that is currently randomizing patients to lenalidomide alone versus just observation. And that trial is nearing the accrual goal, and that will tell us, do we really need dexamethasone in this particular setting, or can we get away with just using Revlimid alone? In the opposite direction, obviously, there has been a handful of patients who were studied by Dr. Landgren's group looking at the same combination of carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone, and again demonstrating that the vast majority of these patients were able to go into a MRD negative state. Now, there is a trial called CESAR trial that is being done by the Spanish group, which is kind of a very similar design as the ASCEND trial, but that one does not have the daratumumab combination in there. So there are multiple groups doing these small trials, looking at different combinations to see what stands out.
Okay. How is the MRD negativity being tested? What tests are you using for that?
Right. So right now we have two tests for which we have sufficient data to say that those both of them are useful. So we have the flow cytometry-based assessment, and we also have what we call the next-generation sequencing. Both of them have been studied quite a bit, and both are good methods. In fact, the new response criteria that's going to be coming out tomorrow in Lancet Oncology defines MRD with either of the methodology, as long as they have the sensitivity of being able to detect at least one in 100,000 myeloma cells. So for this particular trial, we're going to be doing both, because we believe, especially in this patient population, both the methodologies can be complementary, and they might actually give us information that could be that could help us better understand the nature of the cells that are left behind after treatment.
Okay, thank you so much, and thanks for giving us a sneak peek of what's coming out tomorrow.
Okay.
Thanks, Cindy. Dr. Kumar, just following up on that question, will there be also bone imaging tests as part of that MRD process?
Yes. So as part of the MRD definition, it's not really bone imaging. We are recommending getting a PET scan as part of the MRD negative assessment. If the PET scan is negative as well, then we would call it a imaging plus MRD negative.
Good. And then I have one last question before turning it over back to Priya. As you mentioned, there is a lot of interest these days in smoldering patients, and will earlier treatment result in longer-term survival? You've been recently appointed as co-chairman, or elected as co-chairman to the NCI Myeloma Steering Committee. Can you share what role the various cooperative groups like SWOG and Alliance in this country play in kind of bridging that gap between the different approaches being explored for smoldering?
Absolutely. And you know, being on the committee, you know, a lot of the discussions that goes on. And I mean, the goal for the NCI steering committee, which, again, for others on the call, is the committee that actually looks at all the different trial ideas that are brought up by the cooperative groups, which again is the ECOG, the SWOG, and this Alliance. So what has been, some of the discussions have been around, you know, for example, let's take the ECOG clinical trial E3A06, right? So we have the Spanish trial that looked at lenalidomide dexamethasone. So we obviously, the ECOG trial is filling in the gap of trying to understand, is the dexamethasone needed, or can we just do the lenalidomide alone. Similarly, there are new concepts that are coming through the cooperative group mechanisms that are going to look at some of the monoclonal antibody-based approaches, maybe not as intense an approach as what we are looking at in the ASCEND trial. So the ASCEND trial is looking, can we really push the envelope and cure the disease? And the trials that are being designed in the cooperative group is going to take the in-between approach between the lenalidomide and the really intense approach, middle of the road, can we maybe use less intense therapy, maybe for a longer period of time, and still achieve the same goal?
Right.
So I think between what is being designed by the academic institutions and what is being designed by the pharmaceutical companies, the cooperative group really provide a platform to explore the middle of the road.
Well, thanks so much. Priya, I don't know if you have callers on the phone. I know you certainly have caller questions. So do you want to proceed with those?
Yes, thank you, Jack. Yes, we do have a lot of caller questions. And callers, if you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad and let us know, and we can bring you on air to ask your questions directly to Dr. Kumar. Dr. Kumar, we have a long list of questions. Some of them I think we just touched briefly upon, but I would still like to ask them again because these have come from a Facebook group on smoldering myeloma, and they're like very excited about this trial, and most of them are looking forward to actually interacting with you too on this group. I can send you the link so that you can just like take a look. I don't know, this is run by, the moderator of the group is Dana Holmes. So she's unable to join us today. So we have this whole list of questions sent from the group. So I'll just go over them. Beginning with the third one on your list, Dr. Kumar. After the first four cycles of KRD, daratumab, will both arms be tested for MRD negative status? I think Jack just touched upon this, but if those in the transplant arm are MRD negative, will they still receive a transplant? In the non-transplant arm, if they are MRD positive, after 8 cycles, will they be offered a transplant?
So these are really great questions. I mean, I think this is what we are really trying to understand. Even for myeloma, do we actually change treatment based on the fact that somebody is MRD negative or positive? And we actually don't know for sure that if somebody who is MRD negative, if you stop the treatment right then and there, are they going to do equally well or better than the rest, and vice versa. The problem is a lot of these myeloma patients who have high-risk myeloma, they tend to get to a good response very fast. Unfortunately, many of those myeloma also tends to grow back fast. So that's why what we would like to do with this study is to give a very well-defined package of treatment, irrespective of what happens in between, and then see how that would affect the long-term outcome. Once we can prove that that is a beneficial approach, then the next step would be to see if we can modify things based on what happens in between.
Thank you, Doctor. We have received 2 questions on inclusion criteria or the definition of high-risk smoldering myeloma. So will you be incorporating the high-risk smoldering definitions recently published by Dr. Raj Kumar on behalf of the IMF, IMWG, which includes abnormal cytogenetics, or would you be sticking to the old defining parameters like BMB percentage and M-spike?
So for this particular study, we decided to stay with what has been very well validated, not only because it's been validated and has been used for a long time, but also it makes it easy for us to compare with other data sets or other clinical trials. But we will be doing the GEP70 type of or the gene expression profiling type of studies on the samples from the clinical trial. So we will be able to look back and see how those things influence the outcome.
Yes, Cindy was just asking about the 30%, 30 to 50% cure rate. So the question is this projection across all disease prognostic risk types, that is low, standard, and cytogenetic profiles?
Yeah, I mean, we don't really know if the... We anticipate that maybe this intense an approach would negate the influence of those kind of risk factors. But we don't know for that for sure. I think the clinical trial will tell us if we find equivalent outcomes among the different subgroups of myeloma based on the cytogenetic profile.
Mm-hmm. The next question is, I think, from a non-resident American. He says, which myeloma centers will participate in this trial other than Mayo Clinic in Rochester? And will it be in the U.S. only? How many patients will be recruited?
So this trial is going to be only in the U.S., but we anticipate that there may be about a dozen or more centers that will participate in the trial. We do not have a final list as of yet. We plan to enroll a total of 82 patients, 41 of them getting the transplant and 41 not getting transplant.
Okay, thank you. The next one is, I'm interested in the screening process and testing during trial regarding carfilzomib toxicity for patients with and without cardiac history.
So there's obviously someone who has very clear heart failure or significant heart disease would not be able to go on the clinical trial. But we will be watching patients closely by using echocardiograms as well as some blood tests like what we call the cardiac enzymes to make sure there is no evidence of cardiac toxicity.
Thank you, doctor. Next question is, should any patient progress to active disease during or after the SN trial? Is this considered a first relapse, excluding patients from participating in newly diagnosed multiple myeloma clinical trials?
Given the fact that we are going to be using treatments that's comparable to what is being done in myeloma, I suspect that would be the case. But again, a lot of it's going to depend upon how those newly diagnosed myeloma trial criteria is written up.
Okay, I think that completes the list. There were a couple of other questions, Doctor. For what I've researched so far, amplification 1Q21 appears at a progressive stage leading to SMM or multiple myeloma. If so, does having abnormalities of AMP1Q21, deletion 13, trisomy 7 and 9 put the patient at higher risk of progression if he or she is currently MGUS?
Right. So the value of these prognostic factors in patients with MGUS is less known compared to the smoldering patients. So in the smoldering patients, we know there have been studies which have shown that the 414 translocation, the 17p deletion, can increase the risk of progression. In MGUS, you know, again, this is very small data set. When we have looked at these patients, it certainly appears that maybe the patients who have the trisomies are at a higher risk than what we would have anticipated. And that could, and we don't know the reasons behind it. It could be also be a reflection of the fact that these patients tend to get diagnosed as myeloma earlier, but then they do much better than the rest of the patients after the diagnosis. So the total time that we're talking about might be very comparable. But again, mm-hmm. I think this is very, very preliminary data at this point.
Yeah, the last one, Doctor. Is the SCT arm randomized or based upon SCT eligibility, that is fit, frail, or fit, frail status and comorbidities?
So there is no randomization. Patients can elect to, if patients are eligible for a stem cell transplant, meaning age-wise and other comorbidities, they can decide whether they want to join the transplant group or the non-transplant group. If the patients are ineligible to go through a stem cell transplant, they only can enroll in the non-transplant group. So it is not a randomization. There is a patient choice for selection.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Doctor. Jack and the panelists, Cindy and Elik, if you have questions, we have time to go over them with Dr. Kumar.
Elik or Cindy?
Yeah, this is Cindy. I guess not for the ASCENT trial, but for those patients that are on the phone and new to this whole idea of myeloma and smoldering myeloma, could you tell us what the difference between MGUS and smoldering myeloma is, and at what point does an MGUS patient move over to become a smoldering patient?
So a lot of the difference between MGUS and smoldering relates to the amount of the myeloma cell, for one. So when somebody's M spike goes about 3 grams or their bone marrow plasma cell percentage goes about 10%, then they go move from MGUS to smoldering myeloma. There's also probably some biological difference in the cells between myeloma and MGUS, and probably what is happening in the smoldering patients, it's just a mix of those more malignant plasma cells and the less malignant plasma cells. So it's a continuum. So in the muggles, it's predominantly the non-malignant plasma cells, and eventually the the malignant cells overtake and replace most of those non-malignant or non-cancerous plasma cells, and that's when you start showing evidence of myeloma.
Okay, thank you.
Yelak, any questions?
I think the only question I have is carfilzomib versus Velcade or exazomib. Why was carfilzomib chosen over the other two PIs?
Right. So the reason for choosing the carfilzomib was based on, the phase two studies that have shown that carfilzomib, lenalidomide, dexamethasone combination gives a very high rate of response, especially the complete response and MRD negative from the phase two studies. So we thought we will use a regimen that seems to be, it has not been studied head-to-head with bortezomib and dex, or at least we don't know the results of it. So we have gone with the data from the smaller trials, which suggests that that combination may be particularly effective.
Thanks, Jack. I don't have any more questions.
So, Dr. Kumar, I guess I would note for patients listening or will listen to this subsequently, this is an aggressive trial in terms of the treatment protocol, four drugs over a two-year time frame. But that said, for us myeloma patients who have been battling it for many years and on continuous treatment, maintenance treatment as such, if smoldering patients really are cured after a couple of years of treatment and don't progress to myeloma, it's a pretty exciting opportunity, and I hope the trial goes well.
No, it certainly is. I mean, that would certainly change the way we think about this disease and maybe even other diseases where we just continue to watch.
Yeah. And watching and waiting is a horrible thing.
It is. I mean, it's always a balance between, what side effects you could give somebody from these drugs. Some of them may not be trivial. At the same time, obviously, it must be a very difficult thing for people to just keep, go on with that sword hanging over their head.
Exactly right. Well, Yelak and Cindy, thanks so much for your questions. Priya, thanks so much for coordinating the call and reading off the other patient questions, but most of all, Dr. Kumar, thanks for making your time available and educating all of us in terms of the ASCENT trial, and we'll look forward to it actually getting out there and hearing some results in the future.
Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Doctor. Bye. Please visit curetalks.com for details of upcoming shows. This talk and its transcript will be made available on CureTalks website. Dr. Kumar, thank you for your time and sharing all this information with us. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Yeah, bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.